On this edition of Celebrating Science, Jill Tarter on the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. Brought to you by Canada's Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics, an independent, nonprofit scientific research and education outreach organization, home to a growing cluster of international scientists who contemplate and calculate new ideas about the very essence of space, time, matter, and information. Perimeter Institute also offers a wide array of educational outreach activities for students, teachers, and members of the general public in order to share the joys of scientific research, discovery, and innovation. In this presentation, Life, the Universe, and the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, Jill Tarter shows how new search technologies involving observatories and spacecraft are rapidly expanding our efforts to find intelligent life in our own galaxy and other parts of the universe. Dr. Tarter is the director of the Center for SETI Research at the SETI Institute in Mountain View, California. She is a fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science with a PhD in astronomy from the University of California at Berkeley.
I'd like to share with you tonight some insights into an exploratory science that we call the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. Now, who cares about SETI? Well, it turns out everybody does. And it's even gotten into our popular humor. This is an old pogo cartoon by Walt Kelly, and it's hard to read that small print, so here's an absolute plagiarism by Calvin and Hobbes. Either we're alone in the universe or we're not. Either way, it's a mighty sobering thought. And this is an old question. This isn't something I woke up last week and started wondering about. I think probably the first cave people that crawled out and looked up at the sky wondered about other beings elsewhere. Of course, they were probably worrying about the next cave over, but as we began to understand the vastness of the cosmos, our fascination with our place therein has just gotten deeper and deeper. And so we're talking about looking for intelligence somewhere else. What's your opinion of the search for extraterrestrial intelligence? I can't think of a better place to look. And those of us that have been involved with federal funding understand that Washington, D.C. is indeed not a really good place to look for intelligence. And we talk about looking for extraterrestrial intelligence, but really what we're talking about is looking for someone else's technology. Now, I am assuming that the audience out there is quite intelligent. I mean, you chose to come listen to me. But other than that, how can I discern that you are intelligent? Well, I really can't at a distance. But in fact, that camera that just went off and a lot of the other digital technology in the room is very detectable. And if we were to detect evidence of someone else's technology, we would therefore presume intelligent technologist having created it. So that is what SETI is really all about, looking for technology. If you take nothing else home from this lecture tonight, I think there's one really important lesson, and it's the reason that I think SETI is so worthwhile. And that lesson is that you and me, everything else, is made out of stardust. We are intimately connected with our universe. We are the stuff of stars. And anyone else out there is likely to, it must also be. So because we are made of the garden variety entities in the universe, or at least the 5% that we can study today, it makes it more likely that intelligent life exists elsewhere. So, when you ask an astronomer, as my daughter used to do, where did we come from, I give her this answer, and she had a hard time with it, but in fact, that is where you come from. Those beautiful pictures are supernova remnants. They are the detritus, the remnants of a massive star that exploded long ago. And that's the stuff that you are made out of. So think about the iron that's part of that large hemoglobin molecule in your blood. That iron, those very atoms of iron, were cooked up inside a very massive star billions of years ago, on average maybe about 8 billion years ago. And yet, from a distant star, they got incorporated into you. And I find this a really powerful concept. We are made out of stardust. We are connected to our universe. So a massive star shines because deep at its center, it converts fuel. It burns fuel with a process we call nuclear fusion. And first of all, the star starts out as mostly hydrogen and helium. And it burns its hydrogen to helium. And when it runs out of hydrogen, it shrinks and gets a little hotter, and then it can burn the hydrogen, the helium, to carbon and to nitrogen, to oxygen, to sulfur, to phosphorus. That's the biogenic elements. That's us. And it keeps this process up, and as the star gets older, an onion is a good model for the star, with the lighter elements on the outside and heavier elements as you sink to the core. And when you get a core that's made out of nickel and iron, you suddenly have a stellar midlife, end-life crisis. Because up until now, as you put protons or hydrogen nuclei into another nucleus to make a heavier element, you get energy out of the process. That's why the star shines. But suddenly, when you get to iron, it's the most stable nucleus. If you want to put something in there and make it heavier, it takes energy rather than releasing energy. And so, finally, well, in the case of a massive star, in only a few tens of billions, millions to 100 million years, the star ends up not being able to shine. So it cannot hold off the gravity that's been trying to crush it since its birth. And so the inside, the core of the star collapses, and the outside of the star is blown off in a gigantic explosion. The energy from that core crunching down allows it to manufacture the heavier elements than iron, and the stuff that blows off is the good stuff that we're made out of. And sometimes behind all of this explosion is left a radio pulsar, a rapidly rotating neutron star, but always this beautiful detritus, these supernova remnants. And the galaxy is a wonderfully green recycling machine. And what will happen to this material is that over time, it will get incorporated into another cloud of gas and dust that will eventually collapse into a star and planets around it. And this material will be incorporated into those planets and eventually find its way into you. So that is the story of cosmic evolution. And that's why I say that we are all made out of stardust. And that process has nothing to do with us. It's quite likely that it will be repeated other places given similar conditions. So there are a lot of other places where this whole scenario might play out again. Here are two beautiful galaxies interacting. And within the observable universe, looking back in time to the Big Bang, there are something like 100 billion such galaxies. Big number. Within each one of those galaxies, there are, on average, about 100 billion stars. So you multiply those two numbers together, and there are 10 to the 22 stars out there, at least. All right? Well, that's a big number. How big? Take all the grains of sand on all the beaches of this planet, and that's how many stars you have out there. Very large number. And in the last two decades, we've learned a great deal about two different phenomena, that we didn't know about when I was a graduate student. Okay, it's a long time ago, we had a lot of time to learn, but still, it's pretty amazing that in the last couple of decades, we've learned about exoplanets and extremophiles. And both of these tend to make the universe seem perhaps more biofriendly than it was when I was a student. So, extremophiles, organisms that live in extreme environments. And here are a couple of extreme environments that people at my research institute, the SETI Institute, study. Now, it's called the SETI Institute, so you probably think that everybody out there is looking through a radio telescope listening for signals. Not at all true. It turns out that there are a handful of people that work with me on the actual search, and another 130 people who work at the SETI Institute on this broader question of astrobiology. So the question of life of any kind, not just intelligent life, and its existence elsewhere in the solar system or in the Milky Way galaxy, and its origin here on Earth. So this is an extinct volcano. It overlooks the Atacama Desert on the border of Bolivia and Chile. And up here in the summit, at somewhat over 19,000 feet, is a series of small lakes in the caldera. And in these lakes, which are the highest freshwater lakes on the planet, there are microorganisms that are making a living, perfectly happy, and extraordinarily surprising to scientists who used to think that organisms couldn't survive a very high dosage of ultraviolet radiation. Now, because this volcano is so high, it's missing a lot of atmosphere that here at sea level shields us from the ultraviolet radiation of the sun. But up here, it's a huge dose of ultraviolet radiation, and some of my colleagues actually dive in this lake. They actually dive in the lake by holding their breath because no one can figure out what the right mixture of gases is to do scuba diving at 19,000 feet. So these guys have learned how to hold their breath for 3 or 4 minutes. And they bring back samples of these microorganisms, which are extremely interesting because they have managed some way to invent mechanisms for repairing the damage to their DNA that is caused by the ultraviolet radiation. So this actually might be a good model for Mars at the period in Mars's history when the water that we think was there early on began to dry up, and any life that might have been there would have to be able to deal with the stress of the increased ultraviolet radiation. Okay, here's another extreme environment. It's the Rainbow Springs and Yellowstone National Park. It's basically boiling battery acid. Really not very nice for life, except that all that coloration is due to microbes, particularly to acidophiles, these kinds of things, which just love it. The hot acid, perfect for them. All right, here's another extreme environment, also very hot. It's deep beneath the oceans, the bottom of the ocean floor where the crust is separating. And you get this very hot magma welling up from the mantle. And in these superheated steam vents, whose temperatures are enormous in darkness and in huge pressures, we find not nothing. We find really rich communities of all kinds of different life, starting with microorganisms and ending up with macroscopic creatures that just love it here. And this is so different from my student days, where we were told absolutely that the conditions for life were between the freezing and boiling points of water at a neutral pH, not too acidic, not too basic, couldn't have a lot of ultraviolet, couldn't tolerate radioactivity, not much salt, had to have a lot of water, and pressure had to be about 1 atmosphere of pressure. And of course, sunlight was needed for all life. That was the Bible back then, the scientific Bible. Not so anymore, and that's what's exciting about science. Is things change, and scientists, at least scientists who are worth their salt, change with the new information. So here's a microorganism called Saccharomyces ingrahami. And this organism lives in cracks in the ice at temperatures as low as minus 12 centigrade. It has a natural antifreeze that keeps it from freezing, as does this ice worm. It's really creepy. This lives in methane seeps beneath the Baja, the Gulf of Mexico. And again, a natural antifreeze keeps this creature active and happy well below the freezing temperature of water. And actually, I think perhaps the most extreme extremophiles who study cold are my colleagues here who actually dive. They go diving beneath the permanently frozen lakes of Antarctica. You think it's cold out there? No, these guys are really extreme, and that's part of being an astrobiologist, studying life in extreme conditions. Okay, here's a strain of microbe, bacteria, that is called 121 because it was discovered to survive up to 121 centigrade. Indeed, it's happiest at about that temperature, but it can live up to 130 degrees centigrade. This is Radiodurans. This organism can live in the cooling waters of nuclear reactors. It can tolerate a million rads of radiation. Don't try that at home. This is amazing. Its DNA is destroyed continuously, and yet it's managed to figure out a way to repair it faster than it's damaged. Here's an organism that lives in salt. And after hundreds of thousands of years of being encased in salt, it's very viable when you dissolve it again. Here, this is a rock. And this rock is not devoid of life. This is from the dry valleys in the Antarctic again. That green layer, okay, cryptoendolithic lichen. Life has actually creeped into the rock to protect itself from the cold and the dry. It's very happy there. And here, this is some of the life around those deep black smokers at the bottom of the ocean, these tube worms. So life is really far more tenacious than we ever gave it credit for, which means that the potentially habitable real estate out there in the galaxy is more diverse and greater in extent than we might once have thought. So when we talk about life, we really are talking about a body for life to originate and evolve on. And it's from our experience of one, that body is a planet. So life is a planetary phenomenon. And what I mean by that is life evolved on the surface of a planet, was profoundly affected by the conditions of that planet, and life in turn profoundly affected the planet. The oxygen in the atmosphere that we breathe is due to some stromatolitic colonies of algae that could do photosynthesis about 2.3 billion years ago. And if you want to see it in action today, there's a place in Western Australia called Shark's Bay where these stromatolites still exist. And on a day where the winds aren't picking up the waves, you can stand there and look down in these pools, and you see these bubbles of oxygen coming up from the stromatolites down below. That's really cool. That's what put the oxygen into our atmosphere. Life profoundly changed the planet. Okay, so here we have the retinue of the sun's planets. Our star, the sun, and around it, the familiar planets. My very educated mother just served us 9 pizzas, right? Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, and Pluto, but no longer. And this is, that's what everybody's talking about these days. Pluto got demoted. Well, no. It's one of the times in the history of astronomy where we're actually taking the step to revise and correct a mistake that we made early on when we didn't know enough. There are many other examples of astronomical nomenclature which are really strange, and they got their names because we didn't really know what we were studying. But here, had we known when Pluto was first detected what we know today, we never would have classed it as a planet. And this is nevertheless a very emotional topic for astronomers and the public at large. So we'll rule out Pluto. And the question is, how many planets are out there? Well, until 1995, we just had books that said, when a star like the sun forms, it's going to have around it a disk of gas and dust, and in that disk, we will get the condensation of planetary bodies. It's great theory. Oh, and by the way, we said that all planetary systems would be like our solar system, and they would have the small rocky planets in close to the star, so Mercury and Venus and Earth and Mars, and the big gas giants far out. And they would all move in the same plane, and they would all have very circular orbits. It's a good theory, right? What was the first thing we found when we found an extrasolar planet? And the reason that the American astronomer Jeff Marcy missed going down in history as detecting the first extrasolar planet, although he had been working on it for years and years, and the data were in his computer. We found a planet far bigger than Jupiter, right close to the star, going around in an orbit that only lasted a few days. Totally unexpected, absolutely against theory. But that's the way nature is. And so we have now found, let's see, today I looked it up, 115 planets orbiting other stars or other dead stars. And four of the planets actually orbit two pulsars, the remnants of a previous supernova explosion. And there are stars that have multiple planets. And this graph, which is an old one, drawn when we only knew 156 planets, shows these red balls, these yellow balls, excuse me, I'm not that colorblind, these yellow balls, which represent the star, and these green symbols, which represent the planets. And they're drawn here as a function of their position, as a function of the distance from the star. So the Earth is here at one astronomical unit. You see all these planets in close to the star. That was a surprise. They're all massive. They're all lots more massive than Jupiter. But you can see that some of these stars have multiple planets along the line. And what we are now just beginning to get to observationally is the ability to probe this area out here, the area where which would be Jupiter around the sun. Five astronomical units. So one here is one astronomical unit. That's the distance of the Earth to the sun. Jupiter's out here, and we're just now beginning to have data good enough to find the analog of a Jupiter in a five astronomical unit orbit around a star like the sun. We haven't exactly found one yet, but there are a lot of residuals in the data that we've already taken that look like they're going to turn into that in the near future. And the other thing that surprised us when we found these planets is not only that big gas giants were close to the star, but that the orbits of these planets were not nice circles, but they were ellipses. And this process of being surprised and finding a difference from what we predicted has taught us a lot about how planets form. And it's really great if you're trying to understand a subject to have an example of more than one. So now with respect to extrasolar planets, we have a lot of examples. It can teach us a great deal. With respect to life, we're still stuck with only one example. Number two is going to be really important out there. And we'll learn a lot. All right, so we know these planets are here, but in fact, we haven't seen them. We detect them because the gravitational interaction of the planet and the star causes a little bit of teeny wobble of the star. Star is much more massive than the planet, but the planet orbiting around the star causes the star to move either back and forth on the sky or towards us and away from us on the sky. Infinitely small amount, but now our instruments are precise enough to study this reflex motion. And so we infer the presence of the planet and haven't seen any, except, well, hang on, late breaking news. ESA reported the detection, the imaging of a planet around a brown dwarf. And they can see this, they can image it, because the brown dwarf, which is actually a failed star, it has too little mass to ever stably do this conversion of hydrogen to helium at its core to make the star shine. So the star eventually just goes out and becomes a rock. So a brown dwarf is a failed star. But because it's a failed star, it isn't very bright. And because this is a massive planet and young, it's relatively bright. And so because the star is dim and the planet is big and bright, it's possible to make an image of this planet even though it's next to a much brighter object. So when you try and image extrasolar planets, the big problem is what we call a brightness contrast problem. If you take the Earth and the Sun, at optical visible wavelengths, the Earth, right, is a billion times fainter than the Sun. In the infrared, it's only a few million times fainter. But to try in one image to see a very bright star and a very faint planet is extraordinarily difficult. So you need special circumstances, like a dim star and a bright planet, in order to do this. On the other hand, the primary is a brown dwarf. And not only are we debating what's a planet in order to decide what to do about Pluto, but we're trying to understand what really constitutes a planet as you define it in an extrasolar context, extraterrestrial bodies, which are planets, which are not. And some of the definitions of a planet require that it orbit a star. So this one fails in that case. All right, well, here's another one that we just got. Special circumstances. Here's a star, very bright, okay, brighter than that, and the central part of the star has been eclipsed or blocked out by what we call an occulting disk in an attempt to be able to see fainter things close to the star. Well, there's a fainter thing. Is that a planet? Is this really our first picture of an extrasolar planet? Well, maybe, maybe not, because our estimates of the mass of that object put it somewhere between 13 and 14 Jupiter masses, which means that this might not be a planet. It itself might be a brown dwarf or a failed star. So nobody quite yet has the bragging rights for sure to, I took the picture of the first extrasolar planet. But I think you can see that we're getting close, and it's going to be there without dispute not very far from now. Now, these are all massive planets, so we haven't found any planets like the Earth yet. But we're going to, if they're there. A spacecraft was launched by ESA last year called Corot, and in the US, NASA is going to launch a spacecraft called Kepler in 2008. And these spacecraft are looking for planets, in particular little planets like the Earth, which have so little mass that they don't tug on their star very much unless their star happens to be a lowly brown dwarf. So it's hard to find Earths. Their gravitational interaction with their star is too minuscule. But they do something else. if things are just right. All right? If the alignment of the orbit of the planet and the star and your telescope are just right, so they line up, then every once in its orbit, the planet will pass in front of the star. And when it does so, it blocks a little bit of light. Now, in the case of Jupiter and the Sun, Jupiter blocks about 1%, one part in 100, of the star's light. That's duck soup to detect. In the case of the Earth, your precision has to be much better because the Earth only blocks about one part in 100,000th of the Sun's light. So these spacecraft, in particular Kepler, which this spacecraft was designed to do something else, and it has been adapted to be able to look for transits, but the number of stars it can interrogate is very limited. But Kepler was built to do nothing else but to try and find Earth-sized planets in orbit around other stars. So Kepler has a wide field of view. It stares down one of the arms of the Milky Way galaxy, and in that field of view, it's got 100,000 stars that it watches continuously and will do so for at least 4 years. So what we expect to come out of Kepler is maybe a couple of handfuls of Earth-sized planets. And because Kepler is looking at so many stars, the probability that if there are Earth-sized planets out there, some of them will have their orbits correctly inclined to Kepler, that we've sized it. Kepler mission has been sized so if after 4 years we find no Earth-sized planets, that null result will be extraordinarily significant. We will have learned something, not the something we expect to learn, but nevertheless we will have learned something very important. So before this decade is out, Kepler should be telling us about planets like the Earth. And that'll be extraordinarily exciting. So from what we know from our studies of extrasolar planets, we think that Earth-like planets are going to be fairly common. But they're hard to find. They're small and they're dim. And so right now we know about one. We expect that it's one among billions, but I can't yet prove it to you. And so you ought to keep tuned because this is going to be one of the discoveries I predict that you'll be hearing a lot about in the next few years. All right, so we found planets. What about life on those planets? How could you possibly find life? We'll talk about intelligent life later on, but what about old general garden variety life? How do you detect it remotely? Well, one of the things that we think is absolutely essential for life is liquid water. And Mars has been an intriguing object all the way back to Lowell's first sketches of canali on Mars. Or Lowell built a telescope to look at the canali that were talked about by the Italians. And we have a whole retinue of robotic explorers dealing with the surface of Mars, starting with a little skateboard that could, right? We bounced it in a big balloon onto the surface of Mars, and lo and behold, this little skateboard took off and started exploring. And then we thought, we've sent two more robotic Pathfinder explorers, Spirit and Opportunity, which are now on the surface of Mars, still working months, actually years after they were predicted, their predicted lifetime. And they have been trying to understand the story, the history of liquid water on the surface of Mars. And indeed, they have sent back information that gives us many indications that early in Mars's history, Mars was wetter and warmer, and water flowed continuously for a period of time on the surface of Mars. So early Mars might have looked something like this, right? Now, what happened is Mars is too tiny to hold on to its atmosphere. The sunlight comes in and there's water vapor in the atmosphere, it breaks apart the molecules of water, and the hydrogen, the lighter component, escapes. And the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere freezes out as the atmosphere gets less and less dense and things get colder. But we do think that earlier on, Mars was wet and warm. And we think that water went somewhere. Not all of it was photodissociated. We think maybe some of that water is still trapped underground in liquid aquifers on Mars. And if it's there, it could well be a reservoir for life, extant life. Here's another teasing clue. And it's such an amazing result that nobody's really willing to stand up and embrace it yet. But we have found in the atmosphere of Mars a little bit of methane, 10 parts per billion of methane gas in the atmosphere of Mars. Well, what produces methane? Volcanoes. They outgas methane. But we don't think Mars is volcanically active. What else produces methane? Well, methanogens, bacteria, can give off methane. So is the methane that we're seeing in Mars's atmosphere because there's some kind of biology going on that planet? I mean, methane's an interesting case because the methane, if it isn't continuously replenished, would be lost from the atmosphere in 100 years. So because there's methane there now, there's something producing the methane. Maybe it's bugs under the surface of Mars. Really tantalizing. Or maybe it's going to turn out that the observations are wrong. 10 parts per billion, that's really dicey. Maybe this is an error in observation. But maybe it's real. Maybe it's microbes. Isn't that exciting? I think it's exciting. All right? So we've got all kinds of robotic explorers now back on Mars, going to Mars, and recently inserted in orbit around Mars. The Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter has begun to send us pictures of Mars that are unbelievable. This is not the canyons of Earth. These are the canyons of Mars, as seen by the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, these gullies carved by some liquid. This is spectacular imagery. It's really amazing. So Mars is someplace we want to look for life. There are other places, really bizarre places. Who wanted to study planets when I was a graduate student? They were ho-hum. Everybody wanted to do cosmology. Well, cosmology's great, still exciting. But planets are amazingly exciting. And these aren't planets. These are large moons of a planet. Large moons of the planet Jupiter. And they are icy on the outside. But we think that beneath that ice, there are liquid water oceans. And we know for sure that there's liquid water on this moon. That's not a moon of Jupiter. It is a moon of Saturn, Enceladus. And what we've seen is geysers of water being ejected from volcanic type action on Enceladus. So water's out there, and water we think is necessary for life. And so here's a comparison of Europa and the Earth's moon. So Europa, one of Jupiter's moons, one of our prime targets. You can look at the cracks in the ice. You can see this discoloration. One thing that could make that kind of pigmentation is the ultraviolet radiation coming from the sun and the particle radiation from Jupiter breaking up the bonds of hydrocarbons, and not all hydrocarbons, they're all organic because they have hydrogen and carbon. They're not all biological, but they might be. These might be the end products of some photophotolysis of biological material. So what we'd like to do is go to Europa and sterilely, without introducing our own life and our own microbes, get down through the ice and explore the oceans under that ice. Perhaps there are the equivalent of black smokers on Europa. So lots of exploration going on these worlds in the future. And the reason that so much attention is being paid to these worlds in our solar system is what I said before. Number 2 is a really important number. If we could find somewhere else in our solar system evidence that life originated and evolved independent of the life that we have here on Earth, that would make a very strong case that life is ubiquitous in the universe. So number 2 is really important. With respect to Mars, it's a little trickier because if we find life on Mars, we have to make sure that we're not Martians. Okay, how does that work? Early in the solar system, the terrestrial planets, Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, all exchanged material because the early solar system was a really chaotic and bombastic place. Lots and lots of chunks of rock banging into other chunks of rock and pieces of a newly formed planet get knocked off by an impactor and they wander in space, sometimes for millions of years. And sometimes a piece of Mars lands on Earth, as was the case with about 12 meteorites that we've recovered, primarily from the Antarctic ice sheets, where a dark rock shows up very nicely on the white ice as the glaciers melt in the spring. And one rock, Allen Hills 84001, in 1996, scientists said, aha, this is Mars. We can tell by the composition of the rock and by the gases that are trapped in that rock, which are absolute matches to Mars and the early Martian atmosphere. And when the scientists sliced up that potato of a rock, they found small structures in there, which they claimed could best be explained by some sort of biology. If that turns out to be the case, it might be that life originated on Mars, hitched a ride on a rock, and inoculated Earth. It's less probable the other way around because Earth being more massive, it's harder to get out of the gravitational well of the Earth, much less likely that Mars would capture a rock ejected from Earth. But coming from Mars to Earth isn't all that hard. And so it could be that life really started on Mars and just found a nice home that stayed nicer than Mars did, and that we really are Martians. So if we find life on Mars, that's question number 1. Question number 2 is it us? That's going to be a hard one to answer, but really exciting. I mean, this is not science fiction, guys. This is what may be happening in the next few decades. Really wonderfully exciting potential. All right, so a second genesis would indicate, so if you find life under the ice of Europa, there isn't any possibility for contamination and mixing with life on Earth. So life on Europa is independent of life on Earth. That's a second genesis. That would be fantastic. Makes life more probable elsewhere in the universe. So we've talked about our solar system. The next step is other stars. We know there are planets there. And there are missions that are being developed by ESA, a mission called Darwin. And in the US, NASA has the Terrestrial Planet Finder, the /I for interferometer, the /C for coronagraph. This works in optical wavelengths. This works in the infrared, as does that. And the whole idea is to try and make an image of a planet around a nearby star, an Earth-like planet, at a distance from the star where liquid water is likely on the surface, and then to stare at that planet and do a chemical assay, a chemical analysis of its atmosphere. How do you do that? Well, what do we see when we see light from a planet? A planet isn't shining on its own. It's starlight that passes through the atmosphere, if there is any, of the planet, reflects off the surface, and passes back out through the atmosphere and into our telescopes. Now, in the passage of that starlight through the planetary atmosphere, it's possible, if there are certain molecules and atoms in the atmosphere, that they can absorb light. And on the spectrum, when scientists spread out the starlight that's passed through this planetary atmosphere, sometimes they find black absorption bands, or they hope to in the future. And those absorption bands are like fingerprints, and they tell you what the chemical composition of the atmosphere is. And so if you look at the atmosphere of Earth, and you look at this part of the moon, it's not exactly dark. You can see this red light here. That's Earthshine. That's sunlight that's come through the Earth's atmosphere, bounced off the surface of the Earth, reflected back out through the atmosphere, and is now reflecting off the moon. And when you study that Earthshine, you get a spectrum. That is, as a function of frequency, you look at the intensity, and you see these absorption lines, these fingerprints, some due to carbon dioxide, some due to water, and some due to ozone. And this is the kind of thing that life can imprint on an atmosphere, some biology. In particular, if we found ozone, remember I told you the oxygen in our atmosphere is due to biology. It's not natural. It's not geophysical. It's biological. So if we found ozone in the atmosphere of one of these planets, and therefore oxygen, we would have a long story, and there would be caveats, and it wouldn't be, for sure, absolutely certain, but it would be a really good story that probably we found life. On the other hand, ozone isn't going to tell us whether we have microbes or mathematicians. And me, I'm sort of partial to mathematicians, right? And so is Hollywood. So we have this enormous industry with these blockbuster films every summer about aliens. And they're pretty awful, right? They're not things a scientist could love, with, of course, one exception, right? And why is that? Because a scientist wrote this. Carl Sagan wrote a book that has a lot of good science in it, as well as a lot of science fiction and speculation. So Contact was a really fun movie. It's a lot of fun to help them make it. And I thought for your next cocktail party, I'd give you a little bit of dirt. It was good. The science was good, but it wasn't perfect. Okay? It's a little trivia for your next entertainment. Nobody wears headphones. Nobody. I have a blind colleague who was written into the movie. His name is Kent. He's blind, but he doesn't even use earphones. There's too much information that's being processed every second. The carbon intelligence up here just can't do it. It takes silicon intelligence. It takes computers. So no headphones. Also, Hollywood scriptwriters cannot do math. There is an enormous enumeracy, and really embarrassing, Carl Sagan died while this movie was still being edited after it had been filmed, but had not yet, the editing hadn't been completed. And Carl's widow, Anne Druyan, wanted to bring to Carl's memorial service a little clip, and Warner Brothers didn't want her to end up with a clip that was going to get cut out eventually. So they gave her a clip that they knew they wouldn't lose, because this is the first kiss in the movie. So this is the real romantic heart of the movie. But what it turns out to be is a bloody enumeracy. It's awful. And this was shown to a room full of Carl's colleagues, and there was this it was really embarrassing. Okay, so what does Jodie Foster do? She looks up at all these stars. Okay, at any one time, you can't see more than a few thousand, but let's give her the benefit of the doubt. 100 billion stars in the Milky Way galaxy. And she says, well, if only 1 in 1 million of those had planets, and if only 1 in 1 million of those planets had life, and if only 1 in 1 million of those life forms developed technology and radio telescopes, well, there would be millions of signals to find. Well, now check it out. 10 to the 11 times 10 to the minus 18 is not equal to 10 to the 6th. It's wrong by 13 powers of 10. I mean, that's not even astronomical accuracy. Okay, and we complained, and they said, oh, well, we'll loop it. But Jodie Foster is right close on her face, and you can't turn one in a million to anything else. So it stayed. All right, what else? At a radio telescope, if you discover a signal coming from an extraterrestrial intelligence, or you think that's what it is, I'll tell you, the last thing in the world you're going to do is start transmitting on your walkie-talkie. Our technology is so loud compared to signals coming from the stellar distances. Here's an example. We all walk around with cell phones in our pockets. That transmitter has about 1 watt of power. You know, compare it to a 100-watt light bulb, just 1 watt of transmitted power. Now, you take that cell phone and you put it on the moon, okay? 250 million miles away. The signal from that transmitter is the second strongest radio source on the sky. And the first one depends on whether you're talking about 900 megahertz or 2.3 gigahertz, which are 2.4 gigahertz cell phone bands, because they're different astronomical sources that are stronger at those two frequencies. But if the one cell phone at the distance of the moon is stronger than every other radio source on the sky, naturally. So no walkie-talkies at radio telescopes. And lastly, they detected a signal. But did you see anybody drink any champagne? That's crazy. This is the refrigerator that's off the observer's room at Arecibo. And that's the bottle of champagne that we bring every time we go to observe, because we prepare for success. Okay. Enough. I've got to move this along. It's taking, I'm really running over time. But let me tell you something very profound. I think it's very profound. Any detectable technology out there, if we succeed in finding a signal, might not learn anything else, but I will know that they are older than we are. Why? Statistics. Here's a cartoon that indicates what the history of technology might be. So that's some measure of technology. This is time. Okay, for a long time, we didn't have any technology that was detectable over interstellar distances. Right now, our technology is expanding exponentially. We know about a lot of exponential curves in nature, things that grow rapidly. But so far in nature, we've never seen a curve that doesn't turn over, reach some limitation, run out of some natural resource that limits its growth. So we can expect perhaps technology will follow that kind of S-curve. But maybe it doesn't, all right? A lot of futurists talk about the singularity, how technology is advancing so rapidly, and the only future for humans is a bioengineering merger that turns humans into a technology that can evolve rapidly enough, because this wet meat doesn't evolve very fast. Machines are going to learn a lot faster than we are in the future. So maybe this is our future. Either way, if technology is long-lived, you're not going to find it down here or in here in that very short time scale. You can't find it here because it isn't there. It isn't detectable. Here, things this is a short interval of time. If it's there, you're going to find it in its old age. That's the most probable place to find it. Now, what if this is the right cartoon for technology? Starts to increase, and then for whatever reason, it either self-destructs or gets turned off. Well, then the answer is, you're not going to find this, because the probability that us, if technology's on the average, if this is the right picture, they're short-lived, then within the 10 billion year history of this galaxy, when our technology is around, there isn't going to be another one, because technologies only last for a short time and the probability that they will overlap is very small. So if SETI succeeds, it will mean the technology is long-lived, or turned it around the other way. If technology is not long-lived, then SETI cannot succeed. And this story has a lovely expression due to Phil Morrison. He calls SETI the archaeology of the future. And that's because a detected signal tells us about the transmitter's past, because any signal travels at the speed of light and could have taken as much as 100,000 years to cross our galaxy before we learned about it. So that signal is telling us about their past. But because we succeed in detecting it, it's telling us that it's possible for us to have a long future. So SETI is the archaeology of the future. I really like that a lot. Okay, well, SETI's been going on for 40 years since the first radio search, and we haven't found anything yet. That's the first question I'm going to get when I stop talking is, well, why haven't you found anything, or aren't you discouraged that you haven't found anything in 40 years? Let me be preemptive and tell you, not at all. All right. We're trying to find a needle in a cosmic haystack, but that haystack is absolutely vast. It's got at least 9 dimensions. All right? We have 3 spatial dimensions, where to look, and 1 temporal dimension, when to look. Now, for people at the Perimeter Institute, this is probably too few dimensions. All right? String theorists are telling us that, in fact, there may be many more dimensions. But since I've not heard anyone tell me that they are expecting, perhaps, that gravitational lenses could pulse in a series of prime numbers, or that gravitational arcs could be shaped into the form of pi, I think that our searches for extraterrestrial technology are going to be limited, at least with our current technology for sure, to 3 spatial dimensions, 1 time. But that's not all. Electromagnetic radiation, light, radio, infrared, can have 2 senses of polarization. All right, the photons can go up and down or right to left, and you really have to search both. We don't know what frequency these signals might arrive at. We don't know whether it's optical, infrared, radio, gamma ray, X-ray. We don't know. Frequency space has to be searched. And we don't know how information might be encoded on that signal. And that matters when you're trying to build a detector, because a matched filter for one kind of signal may totally miss another kind. And lastly, we don't know how sensitive we have to make our detectors, because we don't know how strong a transmitter out there is, and we don't know how far away it is. So we've got 9 dimensions to search. And we could do a splendid job of exploring these first 8 and still miss the signal because we didn't yet have enough sensitivity to find what's really there. So 40 years, hey, we're talking about a 10 billion year old galaxy. 40 years is not enough time in which to get discouraged about anything. So we are doing SETI in 2 ways. We look for time compression, very short signals in the optical, bright laser flashes that happen too fast for nature to do. The first such search was done in Berkeley. There was a search, equivalent search at Harvard. These programs looked at stars, a few thousand stars nearby, looking for these bright pulses. And now Harvard is using some new technology, a lot of graduate students and a very cheap telescope, to do a sky survey rather than a targeted search. Again, looking for bright pulses. Here's a search that is being done at LIC with equipment that was built by this young lady as her senior thesis. And the great thing about her search is that it uses 3 detectors in coincidence and gets rid of a lot of false alarms. All of the planetary, exoplanetary detection data that has been collected by Jeff Marcy and his colleagues here at LIC or at the Keck telescopes, and this is a spectrum, a rainbow of frequencies spread out in 2 dimensions, and you see these black lines, those absorption fingerprints that are in the stellar spectrum. And these data have been reanalyzed to see if there are any bright laser pulses in these data. All right, and the more traditional way to do SETI is to do microwave SETI, radio SETI, at frequencies where the background emission from nature is low. So at lower frequencies, below what we say is a gigahertz, 1,000 megahertz, what comes out of the wall there is 60 hertz. So this is just above the television band transmissions. Below that frequency, the galaxy is very noisy, gets noisier as you go down to lower frequencies. This is a measure of noise. And at frequencies much above 10 gigahertz, The atmosphere, our own atmosphere, is noisy because of water vapor and oxygen. So this is a quiet window on the universe, and that's where we'd like to explore for SETI signals, at least at first, till we can afford to go to the far side of the moon. So Serendip is a system that piggybacks on Arecibo. It takes advantage of the construction of the Arecibo telescope to do a random sky survey. And some of the data, 2% of the data that's collected by Serendip, is sent out to the world, SETI at home. I always like to ask, how many people are running SETI at home on their computers? Yeah, quite a few hands. That data is packaged up into time frequency units called work packages, sent out to your computer, and you can analyze it looking for signals and send the results back to the folks at Berkeley who came up with the SETI at home project. And it's been such a success as the first really large-scale distributed computing project that now there's a whole cottage industry. You can fold proteins on your home computer. You can look for grains of dust returned by the Stardust spacecraft. You can count craters for NASA. You can do all of these at-home science projects in this distributed computing mode, because distributed computing is not new, but who knew about it except the few nerds who were trying to break codes or factor Marcin primes, right? But now everybody knows about it. Distributed computing got really sexy when SETI became an application, so it was sort of a killer app. Now there are a lot of other things you can do. Here's a project that runs on the large telescope in Australia, the Parkes Telescope. It's based on technology from the Serendip system. There is an amateur program that tries to organize people to use backyard satellite dishes and homemade receivers and computer programs to get an organized search going globally. And then here are two large telescopes. This is Arecibo in Puerto Rico and Jodrell Bank in England, which I used with the SETI Institute's Phoenix project for 10 years. Okay, 40 years of searching, lots of colored squares in this diagram, tries to show that nine-dimensional space. I'm no better at it than the string theorists in terms of trying to put it up on a chart for you. But here's the fraction of the sky that we've looked at. Here's some measure of sensitivity and frequency. And optical is way off the scale up here. So lots of colored blobs, but mostly empty space. We really have not begun to search. And so there's a lot to do. And we're beginning to build tools to do the job better. So this is the Allen Telescope Array that I'm working on right now. It's a project between the SETI Institute and UC Berkeley. And it is a way to build a very large, effective telescope out of small pieces that are affordable. And this is being built in Northern California, just north of Mount Lassen. So that's the southernmost volcano in the Cascade Chain. It's a very rural place. Your cell phone won't work there. You can't get any television reception except from satellites. Very underdeveloped and not a lot of interference, which is why radio astronomers love it. And so that's what the Allen Telescope Array will look like in the future. And it's a way of building the equivalent of a large telescope. And this is the last large telescope we built in Green Bank, West Virginia. That's a whole lot of aluminum. A whole lot of civil engineering. Very difficult to move, to build something that big that moves all around. Here's a small telescope, very easy to build. It's built by a guy in Idaho Falls, Idaho, who makes satellite backyard dishes or trailer hitches or lawn furniture with this process called hydroforming. Really, really cheap because it's a consumer item. And our electronics are borrowing as much as we can from the telecom industry and the whole digital revolution. So very inexpensive electronics means you should use small telescopes. And to get the sensitivity you want, you put a lot of small telescopes together. So 350 telescopes spread out over almost a kilometer. And because each telescope is small, when you look on the sky, you see a big patch of the sky, not a little patch, a big patch. And then because the telescopes are spread out, then their ability to look on the sky and the spatial resolution, the fineness of detail that they can resolve is as if you had a telescope as large as the spacing between all of these antennas. And you can choose to phase up the antennas and look at any small piece within that large field of view. Here's what it means on the sky. The Andromeda Nebula. Huge galaxy on the sky. Here's the full moon for size. So this is many degrees. This is several degrees across. When I use that large telescope at Arecibo, that's all the sky I ever see. So if I wanted to make a radio image of this galaxy, I'd have to mosaic it. Take a picture there, make a radio image there, 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 there. You get the picture. It's really intensive. Okay? And I would never have the ability to see fine structure that was any better than that resolution element. Okay? Now, take my 6-meter telescopes. That's how much of the sky I look at all at once. Now, suddenly, I can look at the entire galaxy all at once. Or a big chunk of the sky anywhere, all at once. And my spatial resolution is set by the distance between the antennas. So here, it's better than the large dish at Arecibo. And so it can be used in two ways, the way we've done the electronics. I can form up to 16 of these different beams and point them anywhere on the sky. And if you're quick at counting, you'll see there are 32 here because of two polarizations. And they're different colors because I can work at up to 4 frequencies simultaneously. And while I'm doing this, and of course I put that beam on a star that I'm interested in observing for SETI. While I'm doing that and doing multiple stars and multiple frequencies at the same time to speed up the searching over what we've been able to do in the past, my radio astronomy colleagues are using a different set of electronics as a back-end detector, and they have a radio camera that essentially gives them a picture of that entire field of view with something like 20,000 pixels. Each pixel has the resolution of one of those beams, but as opposed to your digital optical camera, where you're seeing a range of colors, but it's a limited range because your eye is only sensitive to a limited range of colors. In each one of these pixels, I actually look at 1,024 different radio colors, different frequency channels simultaneously. This allows me to study the motion of gas and dust in the universe. So we have a radio camera and a phased array set of beams that I can point at SETI targets, and we do it simultaneously. So the rule with the Allen Telescope Array is we just have to share a big patch of sky. All right, and so with SETI, here's a field of view, and here are 3 beams that we use simultaneously, and we do that to help discriminate against our own signals. So if indeed I look at those 3 beams, different stars, pointed at different stars, at the same frequency, at the same time, and I see a signal coming from 2 of them, same signal from 2 of those beams, I know it isn't coming from the stars. It's coming from local interference, and so I can exclude it. What becomes interesting is a signal coming from only one of those beams. Before we had the ATA, we used other people's telescopes. And 40 years again, or 10 years for the Phoenix Project, but we weren't on the telescope for 10 years. It's like saying, you're 30 years old, but you haven't been eating every minute for 30 years. You've eaten a little time in that period, and that's what SETI's been. We've been on the telescope a small percentage of the time. We're now about to get a telescope that allows us to look over a huge range of frequencies 24/7. This is some of the technology we've invented. I'd like to show it because it reminds me of the Flash Gordon Saturday morning cartoons I watched as a kid. Zzz, zzz, zzz. You know, this is somebody's death ray. Well, no, this is actually an incredibly wideband feed and receiver system that have been developed at Berkeley. Here's what it looks like inside. And what we're doing is we're trying to look for signals that, as far as we know, Mother Nature can't produce. So here's a natural, this is frequency, and this is intensity or amplitude. Here's a natural signal from an astrophysical source called a hydroxyl maser. And this is one of the narrower features in the natural universe. But it still spreads over a wide range of frequencies, whereas our technology, so this is 1 megahertz, 1 million hertz. This is a tenth of a megahertz, right? So 10% of that. And then this is a thousandth of a megahertz, 1,000th of this range in frequencies. And you can see we, with our technology, manufacture very narrow signals. So that's what we're hoping to discover out there, something that nature can't do. The SETI Institute's in Northern California, as I already said. Here's what it looked like about 2 months ago. We are beginning to commission the telescopes. We build them in this construction tent. We do it really simply and really quickly. We get the dishes from Idaho Falls. We put a backup structure on it that's like Tinker Toys. We flip it up and we put the front piece of the telescope on, and then we pick it up with this T-Rex and we drive it out onto the lava beds and put it up on a pedestal that's already been there. And indeed, we are beginning to actually get data from these telescopes. And that's really, for somebody who's been working on this for a while, very, very gratifying. And I show you this not to just show you that we can make telescopes dance, but it demonstrates the very rapid tracking ability of these telescopes, which is unusual for a radio telescope. Okay, so 42 telescopes, it's the answer to life, the universe, and everything. It's also the number of telescopes with which we're going to start working in 2007, wishful thinking. And here's the 42nd telescope that was erected just a few weeks ago. So we have them all laid out on the lavas like this. We have a plan that takes this kind of trenching and the delivery of electricity and air and all of this sort of thing. We've got a plan that goes for 350 telescopes, but just like Jody Foster said, now all we need is the money to go from 42 to 350. But it will come. And here is the very first science that's coming out of the telescope. It's really not real science. It's kind of PR science, but it's very cool. Okay, so here's the Andromeda Galaxy again, that great big thing on the sky. That's how you're used to seeing it. When we had the first 4 telescopes operating with the Allen Telescope Array and the correlator at the back end, we made this radio picture of that galaxy in one pointing. Okay, not really anything to write home about, except that we were really getting signals through the telescope, and that was pretty cool. All right, once we had 7 antennas that we could begin to correlate, we got this image of the ionized gas, hydrogen, in the galaxy. And now that we have receivers on 20 telescopes, we've gotten this image. All right, I think you get the picture. Imagine what it would be like with 350 telescopes spread out over the thing. So that's what we have to look forward to in terms of the science for radio astronomy. In terms of SETI, the first thing we're going to do with this telescope is make a survey of the 20 square degrees surrounding the galactic center. So here's our big field of view. Here are 3 of our phased beams. That's one of them. We'll use 3 beams at a time to scan across those 20 square degrees. And we only have to point the array in 7 different directions to get the entire inner part of the galaxy, in which we will look at something like 10 billion stars. Now, most of them are very far away, so any transmitters there are going to have to be ultra strong, but we've not done this search yet. It's never been done. Who knows what we will find when we do it. So we do it as if we had 3,519 targets. So after that, we will begin our targeted search with the nearest stars, and we will move out as we get more sensitivity. And we will always keep our eye open for targets of opportunity, such as this star called Shabelsky's star, which is a science fiction prediction come true, but not exactly the same reason. Science fiction writers suggested an advanced technology out there that's has nuclear fusion as their, nuclear fission as their power source is going to have the same nasty problem that we're having with fissile waste. I mean, they're going to have to find some yucca mountain to bury the stuff in for 10,000 years as it decays. Or they could do the sensible thing, which is just to throw the stuff in their star. It's a really safe disposal. The star doesn't care. Nobody living there to complain. But if they did that in sufficient quantities, astronomers studying that star from a distance would suddenly be really startled. Look at the rare earth elements in that star. Look at the neodymium. Look at the praseodymium. They're hugely enhanced relative to what you expect. Ha, somebody's technology. All right, well, here's a star whose neodymium and praseodymium are much higher than predicted. But nobody's told you that this is somebody else's technology. This turned out to be something that we can explain in another way with science and with methodology that has to do with how you process elements in one of those supernova explosions. But again, we will always, in addition to targets like our own sun, we will pick targets of opportunity, weird things out there to study because maybe it's somebody else's technology. And this is just a way that with an antenna, an array of antennas, you can look not only in a particular direction, but you can manage to not look in that direction and look in all the directions around it. This helps you discriminate against interference. So I've told you about what we're doing today. This is something the international community is talking about doing tomorrow. Square kilometer array, 100 times as much collecting area as the Allen Telescope array. And therefore, the ability to detect fainter signals from larger distances. And at Optical SETI, we're trying to think about how to get our detectors, which have up until now been limited to 1 meter class systems at universities, onto large telescopes like these 10 meter telescopes. All right? This telescope is intended to find very, very high energy particles from the cosmos because as they pass through the atmosphere, they make a light trail called Cherenkov radiation. And so these telescopes at their focus have a big focal plane array of diodes that see this Cherenkov radiation lighting up the sky. What if we figured out a way so that each of these telescopes, and if there's a single, only a single one of those pixels light up, it's ignored because it's expected to be noise. But suppose we could put a trigger on each of these telescopes and we could find those same pixels on each telescope that light up. It's unlikely to be noise, might very well be an optical SETI signal. So that's something we're trying to figure out how to do in the past. Optical SETI is probably going to end up piggybacking on very large projects because we can't afford to build the instrumentation from scratch for just SETI purposes. And so we have a lot of ideas about how to become part of these larger projects. So over the next few decades, we are going to explore our vicinity with tools that are much better suited to this huge cosmic haystack exploration that we've been trying to do. Okay, what I spent the last 10 years doing, this is the Milky Way galaxy, and it's to scale. So you see that little pink dot? Those are the 800 stars we were able to explore using other people's telescopes of the past decade. This green sphere is what we will explore in the next decade using the Allen Telescope Array. In the next decade, we'll do 1 million stars with the Allen Telescope Array. After that, using the Square Kilometer Array, we may actually be able to go out this far to do 10 to 100 million stars. Optical SETI will explore out to about 1,000 light years. We're going to search towards the center of the galaxy for strong transmitters. Technology is exponentially increasing, and it's wonderful to be able to plan to use that in order to make our searches commensurate with the size of the undertaking. I've talked totally about listening. What about broadcasting? Now it becomes hard. Who's going to speak for Earth? What will they say? It's all politics. So we're too young. We can't do 2 and 5 year projects. Signing up for a 10,000 year project is not immediately in our future. And that's the kind of thing you're going to have to do if you want to take transmission seriously. So when we grow up, then we can start transmitting. So let me just end by saying, I don't know if SETI will ever succeed. I don't know what the answer is. It may be that we are alone, or it may be that we have to search a lot harder to find anyone else. The wisest thing, though, that has ever been said about that question was the last sentence in the first scientific paper in 1959 on this topic. Probability of success is difficult to estimate, but if we never search, the chance of success is zero. So stay tuned. We're going to keep searching.
This edition of Celebrating Science has been made possible by Canada's Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics through the support of private and public funding partners, including the Government of Canada and the Government of Ontario. To learn more about the Institute and to enjoy other programs, visit us online at perimeterinstitute.ca.